How do some of the world's sharpest minds start their day? By putting their brain first. And it's not just our secret leaders who kick off every day with heights. From Stephen Fry to best-selling author and fellow podcaster Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, who give us rave reviews. So if you care about your brain's health and cognitive potential, think heights. Listeners can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com.
Hello and welcome back to The Secret Lives of Leaders with me, Daniel Murray, and my co-host, Rich Martel. This week, we've got a special guest by my namesake, Daniel, surname Priestley, though, who is a successful entrepreneur and a multi-award-winning best-selling author on topics of entrepreneurship. I first met Daniel after literally just listening to, I think I finished his book the same week as I actually met him, The Entrepreneur Revolution, which is an incredible book, talking about why entrepreneurship is so rife today and what circumstances have arisen through history to make today the best time to start a business. Since then, he has created a series of other books, his most recent of which is called 24 Assets, which is a book focusing on the 24 assets you need to build a business. Rich, can you name some of his other projects, books, and accolades?
I was with him when he was trying to come up with a name for one of them, Oversubscribed, so that's quite a good one. I've read that, and I think his breakthrough one was Key Person of Influence, which is also a very good book. But it's funny, he doesn't actually class himself as an author. He thinks of himself more as an entrepreneur, which I guess if you're building that kind of empire anyway, then I guess you are an entrepreneur in your own right.
Makes sense. And in common with a couple of other guests we have in this series, he's actually a native Australian who's moved to the UK and found the UK to be a great place to actually build a business and build a personal brand, which is one of the things that he is absolutely fantastic about. So if you're the type of entrepreneur who thinks it's important to build a personal brand, then this is 100% essential listening for you.
From Runway East Studios in London, welcome to The Secret Lives of Leaders.
Today's guest is the best-selling author and entrepreneur Daniel Priestley. Hailing from Australia, he started his first business at age 21. After arriving in London in 2006 with nothing but a credit card and a suitcase, therefore questionably part of the financial crisis, Daniel co-founded an events company with two friends. Within 12 months, they were turning over more than £1 million in revenue and were regarded as the UK's fastest growing training and events company. In 2011, Daniel released his first book, Key Person of Influence, but we've just been told that's 2010, so to professionally say it again. In 2010, Daniel released his first book, Key Person of Influence, and has risen to fame as a best-selling author on entrepreneurship and everything around it. Since then, Daniel has released a further two books, Entrepreneur Revolution and Oversubscribed. On top of all of this, Daniel's day job is co-founder of Dent Global, a company which puts on world-class business events with teams in the UK, USA, Singapore, and Australia. So all in all, the perfect person to speak to about turning an idea into a scalable business. So welcome, Daniel.
Thank you very much. Good use of the word hailing. Hailing from Australia.
Yeah, hailing. Yeah, yeah. So and hailing from Caesar.
And rising from fame. Wow.
Yeah, it's very biblical.
It is. Really. It was. I was listening to that thinking, wow, this guy's going to be good.
Big words.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Big shoes to fill.
Yeah. I've had weeks to prepare big words like that. So one thing I've learned in this journey is words with two syllables are enough to impress any Australian.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So just to clarify, so said in our research here that you've had two other books, but it's actually three other books, correct? So just take us through the roster of your books just to clear the and just show that we can't do our research properly.
Okay, so there's an entrepreneur journey, and there's like different phases in the journey, and there's a book called Entrepreneur Revolution, which is about starting up a business, and that was actually the second book that I released. The first book I released is called Key Person of Influence, which is actually normally for businesses that are at the point where they're establishing a leader or an industry influencer. I then wrote a book called Oversubscribed, which was about my fascination with businesses that have a lineup, a waiting list, or charge a premium. Basically, businesses that have overcome the problem of what I call demand and supply tension in a digital world, maintaining some form of demand and supply tension. And then I wrote a book, I co-authored a book called What's Your Business Worth, which is not my book, but it's a book I contributed about a third to. So I've had a few of those. I've co-authored a couple of books. I've been a contributor to a few books, but there's three main books that I wrote.
And did you see yourself, like, you know, 10 years ago, did you see yourself as an author? Is there something you wanted to do?
It's funny, I still don't even see myself as an author.
I don't think if you mentioned your name to most people, they would say the author.
Yeah, I think of myself as an entrepreneur. I've always been running businesses and building teams. And I started organizing my thoughts through writing books. And it started out as a way of kind of like, I felt like I was learning lessons that I wanted to capture just for myself. And I started blogging, and my blog's got some good readers, and then I started doing the books. But no, I never set out as thinking of myself as an author. My mum is a writer, and she writes, and you know, she's a proper writer. She's a trained writer, and she, you know, she can spell and construct sentences and
she wouldn't be that impressed with our two syllable words.
And she, no,
because she walk around, you know, she's one of those, I am a classically trained actor, dare you talk to me that way.
Exactly. I'm
she's a classically trained author, and is she proud of you?
And also a little, you know, she's kind of like, hey, how did you accidentally become a best-selling author?
Yeah, exactly. And can I do it, please? Yeah, no, I'm not surprised. Are you surprised by the fact that you're an author? You know, are you surprised that it's taken off?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, we marketed the book, so
you've been disappointed
I'd be a bit disappointed. Like,
but it's like, if you ask someone if they're surprised at their success as an entrepreneur when they set out to be a successful entrepreneur, the answer is surely no, actually. Like, this was my intention. Of course I wanted to grow a big business. I know what the fuck I'm doing.
Yeah.
As opposed to, wrote this book, now I'm like a really famous author in the UK. That's a surprise. Yeah.
It was a surprise. There's a few lovely surprises. Getting the copy in Japanese, getting different language copies is cool when they send you through, you know, you're now in this language and this language and this language, and you know, the Japanese books read down and backwards. Getting a royalty check is weird when you don't think of yourself as an author, and you also didn't write the book for the money. Then you start getting these checks every 6 months from your publisher, and you go, oh fuck me, that's pretty cool.
So a fun fact, but the first time I ever met Daniel, and I told you the story the other night, but I also, you know, borderline illiterate, because I actually took a 3-year English degree and had to read a book every week, so I stopped reading after university pretty much categorically, but I listened to audiobooks. And I was in going on a ski trip with you, and I was in the same taxi ride with you, but I didn't know who you were, and I was listening to Entrepreneur Revolution the entire journey in on the way up the Alps with you behind me, and I had no idea who you were.
No.
And I was just like listening away, and I got out and blah blah blah, and then we did like meet and greets later, and then I met you, and I was like, that's so weird.
And of course the book is read by a very British person.
Yeah, exactly. So I had no idea.
So you had no idea.
It
says things like, when I was growing up in Australia, you know, it's almost like a David Attenborough style. You meet me and I sound Australian, and you wouldn't be any wiser.
So anyway, very nice to have finally met you and then got to know you. But I think, you know, like most people, I've only really known you from an authorial, I made that word up, context.
Authoritarian?
Yeah, absolutely. I've only known you in a dictatorship format. I just wanted to take it back a little bit, so from the start. So you're our second guest to make it over from Australia. We had our very Australian-sounding Alethea Navarro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it'd be really interesting to go back to the time you were in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So you're already in business in Australia with a growing and solid events company.
Yep.
So what was the motivation to leave?
So from age 21 to 25, I had a super fast growth business. So launched at 21, we did $1.3 million worth of sales in the first year. And then in year three, we were doing $1 million a month in sales, had a national team, and
Australian dollars,
so about £4 or £5.
Post-Brexit, it's the same, mate.
Post-Brexit, it's one for one now. But yeah, I think we had a $10.7 million worth of sales in a year that we'd made. We had a team of about, I don't know, 20 so. And in that year, which was 2005, I did 174 events around Australia. So three a week. And essentially, I was just absolutely burnt out and I hadn't traveled. A few of my friends had gone to the UK and I had it in my head that I wanted to do something different. I wanted to travel. I'd never even actually been above the equator. So I was introduced by a friend to this guy who had a successful product that was selling well in Australia. And he said, do you want to co-launch it and take it into the UK? Do you know anything about the UK? And I remember on the contract, I was only 25 at the time, but on the contract I wrote England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, and spelt Wales like the whale swims. that's how stupid, naive I was. But I had not been above the equator. So I got out of the business that I was in. It was a good time to get out of it. I got out of my share. I put a management team in place who started buying out the business. And these were guys who already worked in the business. And then they also decided that they were going to come and join me in the UK later on. So it was a bit of a pivot, bit of a change. And then came over to the UK. But I really came out over for the same reason most Australians do, which is to base myself in London and to explore Europe.
Right, okay. So is it because when you were in Australia, really your sphere of influence is around Southeast Asia, ultimately?
No, I was just burnt out. I just did 174 events in a year, and I was just exhausted and thought...
Yeah, the slow pace of London seemed to be
I felt like I'd grown up too fast. That was actually my thought, that I was 25 and I was doing way too serious things and taking on way too big a problems, because a super fast growth business, everyone sounds like, oh, that would be the best thing ever to be doing $10 million worth of sales or millions of dollars worth of sales in the first couple of years. But the reality of it is it's really exhausting, and you're constantly battling cash flow issues, you're constantly battling team issues, you're making mistakes, you're letting people down, you're doing your best to juggle, but fast growth is really hard. So at 25, I felt like I didn't get into business to be serious. I got into business to have fun, and this is not fun. So I'm just going to run away and start something new. I at the time, I absolutely loved the startup phase. I love working with a blank sheet at the time, not so much anymore, but I loved the idea of working with a blank sheet of paper and getting something started. And the business had actually evolved to a very grown-up kind of thinking, and I just wanted to go and do something a bit different.
What is it that you don't like about that phase currently then?
Well, I've changed, so I've grown up, but at the time it was you've got to have rules and procedures and systems, and the fun of starting something and then what it turns into pretty quickly of actually management and leadership and problem solving and all that sort of stuff. So the glamorous side of entrepreneurship is creativity and innovation and product development and all that sort of stuff. And then pretty quickly it turns into management, leadership, problem solving, administration, cash flow, blah, 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 blah. So I was very much kind of like, I was driving around in a BMW at 25, in a BMW X5 with a couple of houses and all this sort of, like, I was a proper old man, it wasn't...
Yeah, but you must have thought you were pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought
at 25.
There was a few moments where I thought I was cool.
Yeah, well, why the fuck not? I mean, that's all personally well-deserved, so I think that's absolutely fair enough. Did you raise money for your first business? I mean, how much of that BMW was technically someone else's?
Actually...
Which home was yours?
The BMW was... The BMW was actually probably one of the only things I financed. So the business was launched actually in year one off the back of a credit card. Prior to that, I was from 19 to 20. I was not age 19 and 20. I was working for a mentor who was an entrepreneur. And I was putting a lot of expenses through my credit card and getting it cleared off at the end of the month. And as a 20-year-old, I ended up with a $20,000 credit card limit. Which was rare for a 20-year-old, and I had a gold credit card with a 20 grand limit. So I actually launched my business off the back of my own credit card.
So investors, like long term, really nothing ever.
No, in that business, no.
Okay, fine. So we'll come onto that later. That must be quite liberating then, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
So, I mean, really, you know, you're not answering to someone else. So, you know, I think that's
I mean, we had business.
It's unusual.
We had company that we were in partnership with. We had, 20 staff. So, you know, still felt responsible.
Sure.
But yeah, not investors at that stage.
And the company was called Triumphant Events.
Yep.
So what happened to it? Where is it now?
So we ended up, the decision was made eventually that actually at the core of what we want to do was not events. So the first thing of calling it Triumphant Events was originally essentially that what we do is events. And that's what we're really into. And then as the business evolved, or as I evolved, I realized actually at the heart of what I'm into was the training, the development, the intellectual property, entrepreneurship. Around 2008, I think it was, I'd become really interested in what's called accelerators or incubators. And I was very fascinated with companies that go into incubators, or startups that go into incubators and accelerators, and suddenly they go really big, really fast. And a lot of very big companies, billion-dollar companies, had come out of accelerators and incubators.
Yeah.
And I was getting more and more drawn to that as an idea. And having a background running training, development, events, I was good at that side of things. But being a company called Triumphant Events doesn't really say that actually at the heart of what we do is accelerate business growth.
Absolutely.
So as the business changed, it became obvious that Triumphant Events was not the brand to do that through. So here in the UK, we were running some of the best big entrepreneur trainings. We were people who had built billion-dollar businesses were coming and speaking at our events. People who were best-selling authors was coming and speaking at our events. People who were Dragon's Den people were speaking at our events. So we were doing a lot in the entrepreneur space.
Yeah.
And I was becoming more and more in love with entrepreneurship and the acceleration. And the product that we'd launched here in the UK was an entrepreneur leadership development tool. A personality profiling tool for entrepreneurs to help self-manage and be better entrepreneurs, leaders, and managers. So all of that was like coming together, and yeah, it just became obvious that Triumphant Events didn't really reflect what we did and who we were.
Yeah. So starting from scratch with a new completely new country.
Yep.
Quite alarming. How long did it take you to go from there to the next proper thing, like that was your own that you started up? And where was the overlap with writing Key Person of Influence, your first book?
So here's what happened. I started Triumphant Events here in the UK, and the story is a suitcase and a credit card. The honest piece of that story, though, is that the credit card had a big limit. So people who think that I started a suitcase and a credit card and the credit card was £1,000 or £2,000, no, it was tens of thousands of pounds.
Sure.
So I that probably sounds a little oversimplified. I had more available
credit. It's great in a tweet, though.
It's a great tweet. but I had more credit card spending power than most people who are early or mid-20s do.
Sure.
Because of my background.
Yeah.
And I think it was something like $70,000 that I had available on my credit card. So it was, at the time, £25,000-£30,000.
Yeah.
So I launched with a fairly modest budget for a launch. We launched and sold the new product, the entrepreneur profiling. We had associated training and development with that. We then sourced a product out of the US that was a leadership training and development product, launched that. And things were going really well until 2008, 2009, when the financial collapse or the financial crash happened.
From people spending too much on their credit cards, I wonder. And having two homes.
I think also probably the banking side of things.
Oh, sure. But, if we had to nail three things, I think we would say credit cards, two houses, and BMWs.
Exactly.
Don't throw derivatives in there. Come on, next we'll be blaming Iceland.
Right. It was my fault.
Yeah, exactly. Better.
So what happened was I got into a position where the business wasn't going as well as it had done after the financial crash, because leadership training and development is one of the things people cut. It's not an essential spend. So we felt the brunt of the financial crisis, and it caused me to really think through the brand, the products, all of that sort of stuff. And I had a great chat with a mentor friend of mine who said, one of the weaknesses of your business is you don't own any of your own intellectual property. He said that essentially our business was a brokerage model. And brokerage model basically means that You don't own your own products. You're moving other people's products. You're a sales and marketing engine for somebody else. And that was absolutely correct. It was a perfect spot on observation. So he suggested, why don't you think about, if you're going to relaunch the business, you should really try and develop and own your own intellectual property and have something more to hang the business on, you know, that's yours. And the painful thing with this is that I'd spent a couple of years building the brand and the development of these other products that we'd launched. And then they cut ties with us because our sales had dropped. But then they went direct to market and actually made a lot of money. I built their brand and then they went direct to market. So a common element with the people that I was promoting is that they were authors. So I naturally started thinking maybe I should write my own book. And also the idea that, how do you find intellectual property? How do you figure out what is your method, your DNA, your philosophy on things? And from working with a lot of people who were speakers, who had successful companies, they'd actually talked about that they'd had breakthrough moments in understanding their business when they had written their books or when they were blogging or writing articles. So that got me thinking about writing a book.
Well, as in they would start writing a book and during the process they would realize that they'd never put it down on paper, but they did have a certain way that was them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Okay, that's really interesting. Because I have always wondered that myself. You know, I think the really interesting thing about consultants is like, when do you realize that you've got a unique way of doing this, and what really makes you different to someone else's way? And I guess, you know, just trying and practice on your own.
The writing process is like a mining process for IP. You have to go mining for what's the story that would get the point across, or what's the model that would actually sum this up, or how would you build an answer to that problem? So it's kind of like a mining, you're mining for intellectual property. So a few things started to converge. Number one, I'd become really interested in accelerators and incubators. Number two, one of the very first business books I'd ever read, you know, in my teens was a strange book called The Pig and the Python. And The Pig and the Python basically described the baby boomer phenomenon and said that baby boomers are this massive lump in the population and they move through the whole population, touching everything, changing industries, transforming things as they go. And that you should always keep in mind what the baby boomers are up to and what they're doing. So I had this kind of mindset of, I wonder, you know, if most incubators and accelerators are set up for 22-year-olds who can code, I wonder if you could do an accelerator incubator for 45-year-olds who have actually been in their industry 20 years and they don't understand the technology, but they totally understand their industry. So that was like one of my first kind of ideas that I was playing with, and I was doing, you know, a lot of the people who were turning up to our events were leaders and they were, you know, 35 to 50 as a more so than 20 to 35. So those were the ideas that were converging. So I had it in my head at around 2009 that I was going to launch an accelerator incubator for people who had industry experience versus technology experience.
So take us a little bit inside what it takes to be a writer then. So would you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert? Because this is an interesting one in authors, right?
Yeah, I'm probably an extrovert. I wouldn't say I'm a high extrovert. I actually recharge on my own as well. And I do really enjoy spending like time away from people. But on the whole, I'm a people person and I externalize thoughts and think, you know, chat things through. I tend to.
So how do you feel about putting yourself out there? So it's a really interesting question because your whole USP is really about getting people to create value in their own point of view and essentially putting themselves on a stage and trying to engage other people to listen to their point of view. It's a very outward facing, you know, and if you're not willing to do those things, you're not going to be able to create as much revenue, and really they're probably not the right kind of profile for your business model. So how do you feel about being someone that puts themselves out there? This is me, this is my opinion, and I'm open to be judged now.
Well, to be honest, I like to think that I'm not trying to put myself in the spotlight, but I'm trying to put the spotlight on something. I really hate being the focus of attention, to be perfectly honest. So strangely, like the other night I got invited to speak at the Houses of Parliament, and it was for an entrepreneurial group of, you know, sort of startups and that sort of stuff. And I was really comfortable talking about the times we live in, the trends that are unfolding, the importance of being a key person of influence. And when I'm talking about that stuff, I'm thinking about them being a key person of influence, and I'm talking about the trends and the phenomenon.
Yeah.
But at the end of the event, they decided that what they wanted to do is all line up and get a photo with me. And I feel deeply uncomfortable with that. The idea that I'm someone famous or someone in a spotlight, I really don't like. I like to be the spotlight. I like to put the spotlight on things. And what I encourage other people to do is not to try and be in the spotlight, but just try to figure out what it is that you're trying to shine a light on. What are you trying to draw people's attention to? And make it about that. It's ultimately, for the person listening, they're not listening because they want to know about Daniel Priest. They're listening because they want to know about their journey and their future. And they're trying to pick up ideas. You know, they're not curious about me. They're curious about themselves and their own journey.
Absolutely,
So I feel comfortable. I feel comfortable talking about things from that perspective, that I'm helping someone. I don't feel comfortable making it about myself. I actually feel pretty deeply uncomfortable with that as a concept.
So, regarding your books, so can you take us through, because we talked about this the other day actually, but you have a process for your books in terms of there's a chronology.
Yep.
Can you take us through the chronology and why?
Yes.
And therefore, I guess, what's in the future for the books?
Yeah, so from interviewing 5,000 entrepreneurs...
Rich, were you one of them?
No.
That's awkward. Maybe I'll be asked for next book.
Well, doesn't sound like it, mate.
No, probably not.
I feel like I'm a bit obligated. Do you want to?
Yeah,
time in now, actually.
Yeah. You'll have to.
It's getting dark. So I discovered that there was very much, regardless of business or industry, there was a very predictable path that people had been through. So there's the startup journey, which is the excitement and anticipation of launch. And then there's what we call the wilderness, which is often people being all by themselves, trying to figure it out all by themselves and not having a team around them. The faster you can get out of that to what we call a boutique, you're in a much better position. So the boutique is typically a 3 to 12 person organization. You get struggling boutiques that define themselves by geography, and you get lifestyle boutiques which define themselves by an ideology and use digital and technology and all that sort of stuff. From 12 to 50 people is a really awkward business size, too big to be small, too small to be big, very hard to organize. You need leaders, managers, and technicians, but you can't afford leaders, managers, and technicians. So it's a very awkward size that we call the desert, and you're trying to cross the desert, or you collapse back to being a boutique. And then after about 50 people, you're what we call a performance entrepreneur, a performance business, where you're building a business between 50 and 250 people, where basically you're now a more grown-up business with assets, with, you know, all the grown-up stuff like an HR plan and a business plan and, you know, leaders, managers, technicians and, you know, all that stuff. And then about 250, you actually become a mini corporate and then you change the whole game again. So the entrepreneurial journey, or the books that I wrote, sorry, is Entrepreneur Revolution is very good for startups and early stage businesses that are wanting to, you know, be very pure entrepreneur. Entrepreneur Revolution.
And Entrepreneur Revolution also documents, you know, the history of corporations over the last 100 years, but, you know, the mentality almost in the ecosystem.
It paints a picture that we are living in very special times, and that the opportunity of the times that we're in is really around being in an entrepreneurial team versus a big industrial revolution corporate. Or if you are in a corporate, to bring some of the entrepreneurial mindset to the table. And then the next one's a key person of influence, which is about the importance of establishing yourself as an industry influencer, that essentially the billions of dollars that's been spent on social media technology is like a microphone that amplifies personal brand, and you'd be absolutely crazy not to know how to use that. So in the sense of a microphone, the people who make the most money from microphones are actually not people who know microphones, they're people who know how to sing. So my book is very much, how do you get a message across using the technology? It's not about understanding the technology, it's about understanding your own message. And then the next book is Oversubscribed, which is really, if you imagine that crossing the desert requires you to have a ready-made market and to maintain demand and supply tension as you scale and make sure that you always have enough customers, Oversubscribed is very much getting yourself into a position where you're swamped for customers, swamped for opportunities, swamped for investors, so you can scale. And then the next book that comes out is called 24 Assets, which is a way of codifying business into 24 digital assets that are required for scale. So it basically says, by the time you hit a performance business, you're going to need these 24 things in a digital format. So I'm just really drilling into these are the 24 things that you have to have digitally.
Take us through the revenue. We've spoken about this as well. Take me through the revenue per person theory.
Yeah, so revenue per person, if you Google the concept revenue per person, Google gives you a bad answer. It basically pulls out into one of those boxes. It says that revenue per person has something to do with employee engagement. And that would be true if you had two identical factories sitting side by side and one of them had higher revenue per person than the other and all things were equal. Yeah, okay, higher employee engagement or motivation might be a factor. But ultimately, revenue per person is down to the underlying assets of the business. So, for example, to use a really basic example, if my family owned a big house in Mayfair, or a big building in Mayfair, and we rent that out for $1 million a month, I probably only need three people to make $12 million a year because there's a whopping big asset sitting underneath it. It doesn't need a lot of people because the asset does most of the work. So that is an example where revenue per person is not about motivated people. It's about the underlying asset. So it's actually the same. If you get into business, what really creates high revenue per person is underlying assets. But the assets that matter now are not the traditional assets of land, labor, capital, enterprise. They're the modern assets that are digital. So things like brand, culture, intellectual property, positioning in the market, data, all of that is the new economy asset that drives revenue per person. So imagine a team of four people who magically have 100,000 person database, and it's a really responsive database. Those four people are going to make a lot of revenue per person because they're sitting on a whopping big database. If you take two consultants and one consultant, they're both equally as talented, but one consultant records 100 YouTube videos that are being watched by 1,000 people per month, that consultant's going to earn a lot more money than the consultant who's just out there knocking on doors and handing out business cards. So what we're looking for when we're developing businesses now is to build digital assets that scale. And the way you know you've done a good job of that is that you end up with abnormally high revenue per person. So a company like Google has revenue per person north of $1 million, Apple's north of $1 million, Facebook's just around $1 million. So these businesses that are the world leaders at digital assets, they have tens of thousands of employees earning $1 million per person in revenue per person.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the reason I go with revenue per person is it's a much easier number than gross profit per person. The thing you probably actually see if you're an accountant would be high gross profit per person, but it's hard for a small business to. A lot of the time, small businesses can calculate revenue per person on the back of a napkin versus gross profit per person, which they may not have access to.
That makes sense. So at the same time, you started Key Person of Influence. Is that right? That you started Dent about the same time?
Yeah, what is now Dent. It had a different brand in the beginning.
What was the brand before?
So it was a big brand mistake called Intrivo. Intrivo stood for Entrepreneur Revolution.
Right.
It was an acronym, but no one could say it, spell it, or remember it.
Yeah, I did have that problem myself.
Which is basically strike one, two, and three when you're creating a brand.
So you're always learning.
Can we answer this?
Yes.
Because you were about to ask a question before we went off on a tangent about the process of starting writing the books.
Yeah, okay.
We finish up off first.
Yeah.
And then we'll go off of it.
Yep, absolutely. The way this all sounds smooth post-editing.
Yeah, no, it does. And also, because Dan's interviewing, I have a script here, basically.
Nice.
Yeah. Cover,
so when we were talking about your books, you said there's a bit of a process going through. So speaking with 24 Assets in particular, how do you start that? How do you jot it down? Has it become 24? And I guess a really good question about like all authors is how do you not just sit there for months on end going, what's 25? There must be 25.
Yeah, I did.
How do you know when to stop? Of course you did. I mean, that's natural, right? You never know when to stop.
Yeah, you've got to put a line in the sand somewhere. For the book 24 Assets, I wrote it reluctantly. So
you just want Jack Bauer to star in it? Is that what was going on?
That was
Kiefer
it.
Sutherland all day long. You're like, it's got to be this number.
Got to be 24. Got to be 24. I wrote it reluctantly. When Oversubscribed came out, and Oversubscribed was initially a very quick success. So, you know, it became like in the bestseller charts. It was in the top 100 for Amazon for a while. It was a big success on Audible. And I really did say, I do not want to write another book or else I'm properly an author and I'm less of an entrepreneur. And I just kind of went, I'm not going to write another book. And I was actually talking to my mum about it, and she said, oh, what's your next one going to be? And I said, I'm not doing another book. Anyway, I sat down with a number of entrepreneurs over the following year, and I kept thinking about the problem that they were having, which is that they would hit a point and not be able to scale past that point.
Mm. What was that point generally?
About 25 people.
Okay.
So it was a really common thing that at about 25 people, it was like almost like if you imagine that entrepreneurs are like rocket engineers and they're all getting up to a certain height, but then after that, they all just explode. And you're thinking, why are these fundamentally good businesses just not getting escape velocity? So I started just sort of like, not for writing a book, I started just thinking about, you know, what gets you past that hump? What gets you across that desert? And I was spending time with some people who'd built 15 million, 20 million pound revenue companies that hit the £1 million a month mark. And I was trying to kind of figure out what are they doing differently. And it's kind of hard because, you know, they're a big established business at that point versus a business that might be doing $1 million a year. And you're trying to look for the differences. And I actually, and I've not shared this, but I had this very strange meeting with a guy who was a client, and he burst into tears and he said that his business was on the verge of collapse. And he talked about, what do I do? How do I sell it? It's worth nothing. What have I created? Have I got anything of value that I've even, you know, put all this energy in? But, you know, what is it that I've actually created? And it was in that weird, tense moment. There's a room of about five or six of us, and we're sitting around, and, you know, he talked about his affecting his marriage and his health and his, you know, depression and all that sort of stuff. And when we started picking apart what he had created, I don't know where it came from, but I actually drew a little bit of a model of these are the compartments that you've created in. So you've created intellectual property, you've registered intellectual property, you've got content, you've got a methodology, you've got a look and feel for your brand, you've got some brand ambassadors, you've got vision and values. So I started mapping out like just a couple of digital assets.
And then you were like, wait a minute, 12, 13, 14, 15. This is going somewhere. Right.
Yeah, I thought if I could just get a few more out, there's a book in this.
Bum, I lied again.
Exactly. So it came out, and then it actually was missing about, it was 21 actually. And then I realized some stuff was missing, and I played around with the model. And then I started showing it to people, and I created a little sticker system that they had to use my model that I'd drawn, which was the 24 assets that looked a little bit like a building or a house that I drew. And there was all these different spots, and we had to put stickers that were either red, yellow, or green for had they created something in that space or not. And this little activity that we took people through was just blowing people's minds. And I mean, you know, I'm not trying to, you know, sort of say that some genius thing, but it was a very useful activity for people. It was almost like taking the mess of building a business and having a filing system of places to put it and compartmentalize. And it became very clear, oh, I've done these bits, but actually I've not, in my product ecosystem, I've not done any gifts. I've not done any product for prospects.
How does it compare with something like business model generation?
It would probably be a little bit more of a complex. Business model generation would probably be really well suited if you're in the startup phase.
Yeah.
Whereas 24 assets is very much for I've got 10 plus employees.
Right. Okay.
And looking to scale.
Oh yeah, because I mean at that point you've gone way past business model generation. Absolutely. Yeah. And
would be business model generation for seven figure businesses.
Okay. And is it a visual book at all? Because you've just described something quite visual.
It's visual. Yeah. Okay. So the early stages of the book go through the problem of not having revenue per person, the problem of getting stuck on the entrepreneurial journey, the phases, and taking people through some concepts like income follows assets, not sales and marketing. And it sort of lays a bit of the religion or the philosophy foundations.
Mm.
The middle part of the book is all about the 24 assets and what best practice looks like in all of those. And then the final part of the book is me scaring the shit out of people with the craziness that's about to come in the next 15 years and mapping out the trends that you must surf or be dumped by.
Obviously, I do completely intend to talk to you about these trends because I've been in one of your lectures about the trends and it was extremely interesting. And I have absolutely every intention of asking you to scare the shit out of Rich, who won't know what you're talking about yet. But before we do that,
can
I just ask, why did you start writing books then? Do you think it was actually something to do with your mum, or is it actually just because, you know what, you were on all these flights and it was a cathartic exercise?
I grew up around a writer, so that kind of normalized it. But I started writing blogs on a website that was called Ecademy that I later ended up buying and owning and being the managing director of. But I started out as a user of Ecademy, and I was posting blogs, and I got that immediate enjoyable feedback from writing blogs. And then I progressed to, you know, it's kind of like that was the gateway drug into writing books, and eventually wrote books. And it was just a lot of people I respect and that I had respect for and admired, they had a book out, and I thought that it must be a useful process. There must be a lot of value in the process of producing one.
Okay. Having listened to, mostly for me, listened to your books, as I mentioned, you talk about Richard Branson a lot. Is he the epitome of an entrepreneur?
Well, he's a great example because everyone knows who he is. So my readers are in the US, Australia, in the UK, and Singapore. So he's a very easy... I use him as an example probably too much because I'm looking for examples that everyone's going to immediately know and relate to.
I mean, you could use Rupert Murdoch as an example of an entrepreneur if you wanted. He's Australian.
Yeah, he is. And widely loved. Yeah, and not at all a controversial figure.
No.
No, I think, look, Branson's got to be one of the most iconic embodiments of what entrepreneurship's about for most people. The guy's got planes, trains, islands, and spaceships. I mean, he's got a, you know, it doesn't get much cooler than that.
Record label.
Kite surfing across the channel.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, to be fair.
At 60.
Have you heard about him doing his hot air balloon challenge?
Yeah, hot air balloons.
Quite amazing. Going back into the person. So if Richard Branson's flying around on air balloons, hot air balloons and kite surfing and stuff, what's Daniel Priestley doing on his typical day?
So at the moment...
You're Australian, so kite surfing.
I do snowboarding, I do those sorts of things. I spend a lot of time working with entrepreneurs and solving those channels. I've got a business in Australia, Singapore, UK and USA, so I'm at any given time... We can be having, at any time of the day, the business is open somewhere.
Yeah.
So I find myself often having early morning chat with Australia and Singapore and having an evening chat with the USA sometimes. But I also, because I'm a dad, I put a lot of rules and boundaries around spending good quality time at home. So I would say almost every night of the week I do the bedtime bath time routine. And I make sure that, you know, which kind of kicks off at about 6:30 till 7:30.
Yeah.
So it means, you know, whereas I used to work right through till 8-9 o'clock at night, and not think too much about stopping. Now I'm pretty focused on being a dad as well.
Fair enough. I mean, if you were to interrupt this bath and bedtime process, and let's say instead you were organizing a dinner with the three best entrepreneurs in the world that you could have. I mean, A, would you sack off a bedtime and bath time to have that one dinner? And secondly, who would it be with?
Yes, I definitely would do that.
I can't believe you said that. Shame on you. Your son will be listening to this in years. And...
Son, you'll understand one day.
Yeah, right? Fair. Okay.
You'll understand. Elon Musk would have to be... the first and absolutely, you know, I mean, as far as an entrepreneur,
is he more impressive than Richard Branson?
I think there's something about, I mean, he's certainly more impressive in the sense that he's tackling some really, really big problems. You know, Branson's an interesting character. He was in the right place, right time, and made the absolute most of it.
He's had loads of failures as well. It doesn't feel like Elon Musk has actually suffered as many failures as Richard Branson, really.
The interesting thing with Branson, I mean, and Branson's brilliant, and he's applied a great philosophy to a lot of industries. You know, he basically applies the philosophy of shake up an old industry, champion consumers, and make a fun place to work.
And his brand, right?
Yeah. And he's done that to a lot of old industries and shaken them up. When he was in the right place at the right time... He exited a company for £510 million in the early 90s, so the equivalent of billions today. And had he put that £510 million into London real estate, he'd be massively more wealthy than he is today. So he's actually, from that point of exiting for a lot of money, he's done well, but he actually hasn't kept up with some fairly normal assets. He's had some wins and some failures. One of his biggest wins was by chance. He got into the airline industry in Australia when Ansett Australia collapsed. So he was only operating in Australia for a year or so, and then the major carrier went bust and left a 50% hole in the market, which is where he had his next big win. Now you've got to be in the market to have that win. You've got to be you've got to be in there to experience that luck.
In it to win it.
Yeah, Musk is a little bit of a different category. He reinvents industries deliberately, and he's quite clearly working with a genius level IQ. He's tackling insurmountable problems that I don't think any mere mortal could do, and I don't think, I don't think he's in the right place at the right time. He positions himself in the right place at the right time. I mean, it's bonkers the types of stuff Musk gets himself involved in, and the levels of stress and problem solving that he throws himself under the bus with.
What would you ask Elon Musk as your first question?
If I had the opportunity to have dinner with Elon Musk, to be honest,
I'll sort it out, mate. Don't worry.
To be honest, I'd ask what he needs help with. What I can do to support.
And I think that's a sign of an amazing entrepreneur, that others look up to him and just think, I want to be on that ride and just help you make it happen.
Yeah. So I would really, I'd ask his feedback as to in what ways he thinks I can use my assets, my skills, my talents to impact more people. And is there anything that I'm missing because I'm too close that would be a logical extension that would impact more lives than I'm currently able to?
Mm.
So I'd probably be talking to him about that.
Branson?
Yeah, definitely. Let's have Branson at the dinner party too. Although I feel like I'd be left out of the conversation at that point.
Well, it depends on what you're asking, mate. You're controlling it.
Basically,
you're pouring the wine as well.
I think I'd be sitting there just listening at that point, where they're basically talking about, you know, their typical day, and I just want to shut up and not really share mine.
You'd be like, well, you guys are there for bath time as well, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Sack the son off. He's upstairs hanging out with the lads. What would be your first question to Branson then? What would be the main thing you want to ask him? Or talk about with him?
It would be very similar, and it would be along the lines of what am I missing, you know, or what support can I offer you, or in what big global problem or big challenge do you think the world faces that I could have an impact on? You know, and just be curious on those sorts of things. I'd probably ask him how he gets his hair so...
Yeah, it's quite lion maning. Yeah, it's quite impressive.
I would ask whether he's modelled himself on Aslan or something like that.
It does look a lot like it. It's a great shout. Who would your third guest be?
I think I'd be interested to work with... I'd be interested to have like a social entrepreneur, like Lynn Twist or... you know, or someone who's doing Sylvia Earle, who's not necessarily a classic entrepreneur, but is using an entrepreneurial mindset to tackle a big problem.
Mm.
So someone who's, you know, Sylvia Earle and the oceans, Lynn Twist, ending hunger, working with Indigenous people. You know, someone who's
kind
of...
You're really getting left out of the conversation, because the other two could probably own that as well.
Yeah, so. I know. So they're just sort of like batting, you know, ideas around, talking about, you know, what do you do when your rocket, you know, isn't flying the way that you want it to? And, you know, and what do you do when you're trying to save an ocean and...
Well, at least this way, if we let you have both those guests as well, then you've got four guests, two are women, two are men, and actually there's a nice equilibrium at the table
there
as well.
Go.
And that's, you know... a better host at the very least.
Exactly.
Okay, so how would you describe yourself? So you've asked these guys for dinner and they're like, yeah, sure, Dan, no problem. Just a little quick Google. Oh, he's the author, which is the label you hate. So how do you describe yourself?
I would describe myself as someone who runs a entrepreneur accelerator, passionate about the times that we live in, you know, working with entrepreneurs across the world to build, you know, global small businesses, successful businesses.
So interestingly on this point, because we always ask our guests how to describe yourself, and some describe their business, and their mission, and some people describe themselves. So, and then some people are, you know, very self-aware about it as well. They're like, but, you know, that is me. Where do you sit in that? You know, do you hear me say that back and think, shit, I did just describe the business?
Yeah, well, I did describe the business. I mean, essentially who I am is not necessarily intrinsically terribly interesting. I write books. I've been a best-selling author. I've built businesses. I've supported some charities and all that sort of stuff. But essentially, I'm just a guy who grew up on the Sunshine Coast in Australia, didn't want to stay in that community, started businesses, travelled around. And
are you well-known in Australia?
Yeah, reasonably. So when I went down there a little while ago, about 400 or 500 people turned up to my talk.
Okay.
And it was about $100 a head. And the books have sold incredibly well in Australia. If I put on a webinar, you know, a few hundred people from Australia will jump on, even if it's a bad time zone.
Do you feel any duty to ignite entrepreneurial attitude in Australia? I'll be honest and say I don't know if there is one, isn't one, but like the only thing, you sometimes get sucked into your own microcosm, right? It's very clear in the UK, it's a big focus for the government that's funding. There's this whole setup here to make sure, and a lot of the most famous entrepreneurs and successful entrepreneurs in the world are British.
Yeah.
Joking aside, Rupert Murdoch aside, there's not that many like big names like him. So is that a systematic problem in Australia? Do you see that as something like a mission later in life? It'd be nice to go and help? Or am I completely wrong and there's shitloads of them?
Australia is incredibly entrepreneurial. What you tend to see with Australian entrepreneurs is that they hit a certain size and they head to New York or they head to LA or they head to San Fran or they head to the UK. You'll actually find a lot of people who are COOs, leaders. There's a lot of C-suite. I think Australians punch well above their weight for quietly getting on with building and running businesses. And they tend to be all over the world. Like for a small country of 20 million people, there's a lot of Australians in San Fran, a lot of Australians in...
And like we say, you're our second entrepreneurial guest that's Australian.
Yeah.
In 10 guests.
So there's that. It's a killer. It's a great community. Probably one of the downsides with Australia is that it's Disneyland. Nothing terribly bad happens there, so it's very easy to be comfortable, and you're not confronted with big problems and challenges because it's just such a very happy, easy country.
Sure. And a lot of people, just relating this to America, a lot of people say this about San Francisco and LA. It's like, well, I'd rather run a business in LA, like in many ways, but it's too comfortable, the weather's too amazing, the beach is there, the lifestyle's amazing. I just don't feel that like get up and go that I do in San Francisco, so I kind of chose to be there. Yeah. You know, that San Francisco is not an absolutely beautiful place, but it does have that extra drive.
Just a little bit of an edge.
Yeah, precisely. What kind of routine do you have? Are you an early bird, late owl? Like you mentioned, having to talk to people all around the day. Do you sleep much?
Yeah, so my son wakes me up at about 6:30, 7 o'clock every morning.
Yeah.
And I spend from 7 to 8:30 playing Legos and hanging out with him and answering text messages and responding to a few emails.
So he's got an iPhone.
Yeah, so what we'll do is we'll play some games and he'll have the Legos out and all that sort of stuff, or we'll be doing some drawing or watching some YouTube videos.
Give him 24 blocks and red, go sort this out in order.
Exactly. Red, yellows and greens. And then on the side, without him noticing too much, I'll start responding to a few of my emails. And then I typically will do my first meeting around 8:30 on Skype. And then I only go into my own actual offices twice a month. So I have an office here in London. We've got several offices. We have an office in Milton Keynes. We have an office in London. We have an office in Singapore, Australia. I find that I'm a disruptive force in the office if I'm in there too much. So I only go in twice a month. So
it's
I often,
a great excuse as well. It's
great
like, guys, it's not for me, it's for you.
For your benefit. So I will typically, no 2 weeks are the same because I do a lot of speaking. So sometimes I'm speaking internationally and I need to fly off and fly back. Sometimes I'm speaking around London. Sometimes I'm just meeting people. I have a private members club that's just down the road from my house. So I'll just kind of head on down to the private members club and meet a few people there.
Is that in West London?
Yeah, in Home House.
Okay.
So I do a lot on Skype. I do a lot of face-to-face. I do a bit of speaking, and I have two executive assistant roles that basically find good opportunities and put them in the diary.
To Two final questions. One, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? And part two, because obviously it was really three questions because I snuck another one in. What's the best piece of advice you'd give to people starting off now on their own entrepreneur journey?
So the best piece of advice I ever got was create versus consume. So it was essentially that all joy comes from creation and pain and suffering comes from consumption. And that the more you're a consumer, the more you wear yourself out and wear yourself down, and the more you're looking to consume things, the more you energetically lower your energy, and the more you're engaged in the creative process, the more you raise your energy and the more you get out of it. So essentially the act of writing a song is better than listening to a song. The act of writing a book is better than reading a book. The act of doing something newsworthy is better than watching the news. The best advice I got was this idea of stop trying to consume things and only focus on creating things, and don't try and avoid the creative process, lean into the creative process, because creating stuff is hard but ultimately joyful. Consuming stuff is easy but ultimately depressing.
Love it. That's great. So that's your advice you've been given.
Yeah.
Now you have to be really insightful and think of some other piece of advice that you can give to people.
So depending on...
Because you can't just copy your own advice. Yeah, that's true. That's not fair.
It would be definitely different for where someone's at in their... People need to hear different things at where they are in different stages. But one of the good ones I like to share is you get what you pitch for. So you get what you pitch for is essentially a lot of people are waiting for something to happen, and actually you need to go out and pitch it. And the pitch that matters most is the 1,000th pitch. So you pitch things into existence by pitching them repetitively to a lot of people over and over again. The I Have a Dream speech, believe it or not, was actually the 1,000th pitch. So he'd done 3 years of the I Have a Dream speech at every little church, 10 times a week. And then he ends up doing the I Have a Dream speech in front of Washington, and it becomes the I Have a Dream speech, but actually it was pitch number 1,000. So advice that I give to a lot of people is you get what you pitch for. If you're pitching this is hard, it'll be hard. If you're pitching no one's joining my team, no one will join your team. If you pitch this isn't fundable, it won't be fundable. So if you want it to be fundable, you're going to have to pitch it as fundable. If you want someone to join the team, you have to pitch it as a great opportunity. But essentially, you're going to get what you pitch for.
So you create the story with positive thinking and repetitive action.
Yeah, less about positive thinking, because I think most of entrepreneurship is good pitching despite negative thinking. I wouldn't say I'm a positive thinker. I have days where I'm pretty negative and days that I'm positive and days that I'm just in the dark. But I'm conscious of the idea that regardless of what's going on in my inner world, I have to do good pitching. If I'm going to pitch to my team, if I'm going to pitch to investors, if I'm going to pitch to clients, I need to put them first and make sure that I'm clear and credible and solving problems for them regardless of what I'm personally thinking.
Very fair. Okay, so the last question is the big one, which is what does the future hold for planet Earth?
So the future is going to be massively disrupted on two axes. So the first axis is technology and the second axis is demographics. So demographics is basically what you do predictably when you hit certain ages. So we actually have a huge demographic, a lump of people turning 70 at the moment called the baby boomers. They were born 1946 to 64. So believe it or not, every single day this year is a new Guinness World Record for the most 70-year-olds and the most people turning 70. And that will keep going for the next 10 years. So we have this massive aging population. When you turn 70, you pay a lot less tax, you earn less, you have more health and mental health issues. So all of those things are about to happen in droves for a huge number of people in the population, especially outside of London, because London is a magnet for young, enthusiastic people. So when you go outside of London, you're going to get older, less enthusiastic people, and considerably older populations. So this is a huge disruptive force that causes or helps to cause things like Brexit and Trump and all of that. When people say I'm not earning as much as I used to, that's actually normal, just demographics, that statistically you're going to lose a third of your income from 55 to 65.
Yeah.
So not earning what you used to is just like...
It's not quite got anything to do with immigrants so much as your own like aging process.
Yes, exactly. So it's kind of like saying I get taller from 10 to 20 and then I'm not taller anymore. It's fairly normal. So, and then on the flip side, you have on demographics, you have a huge population called the millennials, who essentially are currently 20 to 35. And that population are radically different and reinventing everything as well. So they're doing the sharing economy. They're the most in debt generation ever. They don't have servicing debt servicing like any other generation. House prices are 20 times the average millennial wage versus 4 or 5 times the average wage for boomers. Boomers want to sell houses to fund retirement. Millennials don't want to buy them. Boomers bought cars. Millennials don't buy cars. Boomers got married at 25. Millennials get married at 35. Boomers didn't have credit cards until they were 30. Millennials had credit cards at 17, 18. So they're very different generations. Ownership versus access, access versus ownership is the mindset of a millennial. Ownership is a mindset of a boomer. So you
and
actually
kicks people off the ownership ladder in itself.
Yeah. So you have this selling pressure of boomers wanting to sell things they own, and millennials only want to access them for a night or two. So demographics are going to cause a massive shift. The other axis is technology. We've now hit a point where technology unemployment is on an exponential curve. So when I was a kid, the cool kids worked in CD shops, the geeky kids worked in bookshops, and everyone else worked in the checkout. So no one works in CD shops or bookshops or checkouts anymore, because all of those things have been automated. And behind the scenes there, the accountant who used to do the store accounting is automated. The stock controller who used to choose how much stock to reorder is automated. And all through the chain, more and more of the chain is now completely automated. And people say, oh, robots doing jobs. And no, robots don't do jobs, but a consultant in LA who's releasing regular YouTube videos is winning market share from a consultant here in London who's not. It's not a robot, it's just using technology. So pieces of software. The other thing too is if software does even heavy lifting, it costs jobs. So if a team of 6 can now do something that a team of 10 used to do because of software doing some heavy lifting, that's costing jobs. To put this also in perspective, Vodafone has 100,000 employees and WhatsApp has 250 employees. Hmm. Now, WhatsApp has a bigger user base than Vodafone. WhatsApp is serving more text messages and now more phone calls than Vodafone. And Vodafone has 100,000 employees and WhatsApp's 250.
Vodafone makes a lot more money though.
Currently, yeah. But, you know, WhatsApp was sold for $19 billion for a reason, and they have a business plan around it.
Mm.
You know, Amazon has 150,000 and it disrupted Walmart with 2.5 million. So, you know, we're seeing some big disruption, and whoever disrupts Amazon, by the way, will probably only have 1,000 employees. So we actually have technology unemployment. We have speech recognition coming on board very quickly, which really creates technology unemployment. We have AI systems coming on board, you know, algorithms that self-correct, which creates more technology unemployment. So all of this sort of stuff, it doesn't just create technology unemployment, it also creates globalization. So you can move jobs to a low-income country. But believe it or not, automation is actually costing more jobs in China than anywhere else. So manufacturing has doubled in the US since 1985, but with 1/3 of the workforce. And in China, Foxconn just got rid of 40,000 employees because they use technology to automate those roles. And they intend to get rid of another 120,000 next year. So China's losing jobs to automation, but there is globalization. Mm. And then the other loser is the governments. So governments for 5,000 years have defined themselves by geography, and they put a ring fence around their border, but digital just is planetary. So essentially you get planetary small businesses and planetary companies that define themselves as wherever they are on the planet and everywhere.
Like Estonia's e-passport.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And they and also just, you know, you would never imagine a technology company saying, oh, we're only going to be geographically limited to this. You know, we're going to call ourselves UK Google, or we're going to call ourselves, you know, Singapore Facebook, and only, you know, only ever Singapore.
Mm.
So as soon as you get a global digital business, they can bounce money around at the speed of light. And basically governments can only police their geographical borders. So governments are running on an old software called geography, and companies are running on a new software called brand and ideology and digital. So governments are going to take at least 15 years to figure this out. And not only that, they've set themselves back so far because they've chosen the wrong problem. So they've chosen this problem called sort out the EU rather than...
Or immigration in general.
Yeah, let's chase after migrants, Muslims and millionaires, as opposed to let's actually figure out the times that we live in. So so all of those converging trends. And then if you want to add a fifth trend, it would be the fact that we're facing some pretty big planetary problems as far as climate change, species extinction and all of that. So you've got these big convergent problems. All of these problems converge in one axis in the next 10 to 15 years.
So another insightful interview with a rather intelligent man that's documented a whole load of entrepreneurial stories and put them down on paper rather than just thinking or talking about them or holding that knowledge to himself. So a secret life of a leader exposed and shared in the wildest ways. And what do we actually have in store next week for our passionate listeners, Rich?
So next week, we've actually got another Aussie, Alithya Navarro, which Dan actually had trouble saying her name, even though she corrected him the first time. For the rest of the interview, he called her Alicia, which she kind of went along with, which is cool. It's a reflex.
It's expected that you'd say Alicia, and of course, being the Brit that I am, I'm unbelievably uncultured. So.
Yeah, well, she was fine with it, but it was a brilliant interview. She's a very interesting entrepreneur.
And funny.
And very funny, and you know, somebody else has come over from Australia, kind of, you know, what I find really interesting about her is that she has absolutely no qualms about calling herself a massive geek. And she doesn't look like a massive geek, but deep down, she is a massive geek. We go through the trials and tribulations of her building a company with her co-founder, Joe, called Skimlinks. It was originally called Skimbit. And it's one of the breakthrough successes in the UK tech scene. So you can subscribe to us on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. You can also find all of the past episodes on our website, secretleaders.com. And if you want to get in touch, simply email us at hello@secretleaders.com. So until next time, have fun.